Case number 15-1163. Dennis Lauterbach, Sr., Petitioner v. Michael P. Huerta, Administrator, Federal Aviation Administration, et al. Mr. Zimmering for the petitioner, Ms. Gardner for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for agreeing to hear this case. The FAA in this case has tried very hard to characterize our argument as being a challenge to the constitutionality of the successive criminal and administrative sanctions applicable in these types of cases. And indeed, we are not challenging the constitutionality or even suggesting that it is improper to impose an administrative sanction of revocation followed by a criminal sanction or vice versa. That's not our issue. Our issue is a little more subtle. We believe the issue is the successive administrative proceedings. This case started more than 11 years ago, and there have been no acts that have happened since the acts that were discussed back in 2004, latter part of 2004, early part of 2005. There was an administrative proceeding. The FAA sought to revoke under Section 44726, and which is the permanent revocation for a counterfeits part violation. The FAA chose not to. They moved forward. They chose not to revoke under 44726 at that time. They made a determination that for whatever reason it wasn't appropriate to do so, and indeed revoked on under 44709, which is their general revocation and suspension authority. The later criminal prosecution, again, we have no constitutional challenge. We raise no constitutional challenge with that. What we do believe, though, is now that they're going back and trying to revoke again under 44726, it's that successive administrative revocation after having made a determination back in 2005 that it didn't apply.
But Mr. Zimmering, it seems that both as a formal matter and as a matter of the purpose of the statute, that you're missing what's important here. Formally, there is no prior preclusive determination under 44726. There was a civil settlement, and indeed it was a settlement under 44709. And how could it be preclusive? It's a settlement. And it makes perfect sense that the statute is set up this way. It seems more a question not of preclusion but of congressional intent, no? That Congress says, the government shouldn't have to stand back and wait for the most serious offenders to be criminally prosecuted. That wouldn't make any sense. You take the first step is the civil removal of certification. Then if somebody's criminally prosecuted, Congress also said that if somebody's successfully criminally prosecuted, we want that person to no longer be certified, and either as a mechanic or as a pilot. It seems to make perfect sense that there would be these three steps, precisely the steps that were taken against your client.
Your Honor, I would argue that it's intended to be a 1-2 step. Either the criminal prosecution happens first, in which case the FAA follows and with the permanent revocation, or the FAA permanently revokes.
But Mr. Zimmering, why does that make sense, given that the most serious cases are going to be those that are criminally prosecuted, and in a busy and crowded district like we see in Texas, this is going to take a little bit of time? Wouldn't make any sense to say that the civil process, the administrative process, is disabled potential pendency of a criminal process? Doesn't make any sense.
I'm not suggesting that it should be.
I thought that's precisely what you were suggesting.
It's the first administrative proceeding was a revocation under 44726. It started as that, and the FAA made the determination that it was not appropriate in that case. There were no new acts. There's nothing new.
Weren't there two things that the FAA could have done rather than proceed under 44726? One, they could have saw the revocation that wasn't permanent under 44709, or B, they could have suspended, sought to suspend rather than revoke his certification. Either one of those actions would have kept him from operating, right?
Well, and actually, indeed, they did move under 44709 initially, as well as 44726. They chose to, in their initial order of revocation, they said, you're revoked under 44726. You're also revoked under 44709. After litigation, ultimate settlement, they made the determination, 44726, they must have made the determination that revocation under 44726 doesn't apply in that case because they withdrew it.
Do you have in the record before us whatever the documentation was that resolved the 2006 action?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the... there was the amended order of revocation, which in page 100 of the appendix, which was issued on October 26th. That was the resolution. And in fact, I would point out that in that amended order of revocation dated, where did I just say? The October 26, 2006 amended order of revocation, it does retain the fraudulent language statement that he engaged in fraudulent behavior and that the revocation was appropriate. So as compared to the November 4, 2005 amended notice of proposed certificate action and the consolidated, the February 14th consolidated immediately effective order of revocation, which provided both under 709 and 726. So it was on the table, it was there, they made the decision. What the FAA is now arguing is that the statute is mandatory. They're required to proceed in the manner that they are, yet they were required then as well. So one of the determinations that they made was, well, maybe it's not as mandatory as it would, as it reads, because that's the determination that they made in 2006. And now they're going back and saying, well, no, we decided it's got to be mandatory in all cases.
What do you think we should make of the language in 44726 subsection E that says that if you've been revoked under B1B, but there's a later criminal prosecution and you're acquitted, then the revocation under B1B has to be set aside? Or it could be read that it's mandatory to set aside in some circumstances, but optional to set it aside in other circumstances.
Well, I think that it would go to show that I don't think it's applicable in this case because he wasn't acquitted. But
what does it show about how we should think about what is a claim or how we define the common nucleus of facts? Or you raised judicata argument?
Well, I think that I think that's indicative that initially we are looking at the facts that the airman is accused of conducting, and that's what's controlling. It's the set of facts that he did. In their brief at page 18, the FAA cites the Lawler versus National Screen Services case on this issue of res judicata / claim preclusion, and it says that it can't be applied when there's new conduct after the original order. And I think that actually says a lot because there was no new conduct after the order. It was simply additional actions taken against him for the original conduct.
So, I understand, Mr. Zimmering, the equities of your position, that we're talking here about, from Mr. Lauterbach's position, one course of misconduct, and the government's treating it in one way civilly at the hands of the FAA, further treating it at the hands of the criminal prosecutors, and then there's a follow-on treatment by the FAA.
Correct.
And it just, there's these three different layers. And I guess the question is, what prevents that kind of a, if we think that's what Congress intended, is to allow the FAA to be the take the first crack, but if there's a prosecution that succeeds, then the FAA is directed to take further action, and really the, you know, the further conduct, and I understand it's not your client's conduct, but the thing that's happened in the world is that he's been criminally convicted. And what prevents Congress, assuming that that's what we think Congress intended, from treating your client's single set of actions that way?
Well, again, it's our belief that the intent was never for this 1-2-3 punch. It was only a 1-2 punch, civil and criminal. And that's why we're not, even if the initial actions of the FAA back in 2005, 2006, even if their initial determinations don't act as a complete bar to the new administrative proceeding, we're suggesting that the previous administrative proceeding shouldn't be taken off the table. The FAA has taken the position that this story started with the conviction. All we're saying, at the very least, the previous to the conviction should at least be on the table for consideration.
And you're saying it's not a 1-2-3, it's a 1-2. Is there anything in the statute or in the legislative history that you would point to illuminate that? Because you really briefed this as a preclusion case, not as a statutory.
Well, I understand, and I don't think there is, you know, comparable to 44.710, which is an analogous statute, that seems to be the cases as well. The Zoukas case, which the FAA discusses in their brief, that was a challenge to the 1-2, and we're not making that. It's that 1-3 that we're challenging.
Are you really making a res judicata argument here, or are you just making a statutory analysis argument? Because it sounded like you were arguing that it was precluded, but now it doesn't sound like that's what you're arguing.
Well, I think we've made both. We believe it should be preclusive, but we would concede that it would be that could be a tough stretch as well.
Well, because the problem here is how do you deal with this court's Drake decision, which says it can't be precluded if it hadn't happened yet.
Right, and which illustrates the difficulty with this statute, and you know, I don't know that it was ever intended to be applied this way, because the Drake decision discusses the facts that occurred, but compared to the Lawler, where they used the word conduct, not facts, and it was the conduct of Mr. Lauterbach that is at issue, we believe should be at issue. And so again, even if it's not preclusive, we just believe that the initial determinations that have been made back in 2005, 2006, should at least be available for consideration, as the ALJ Mullins did in this case, and consider it, and in this case determine that the permanent revocation is not appropriate.
Okay.
So I did go over. I would like to reserve a small amount of time for rebuttal if possible.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Casey Gardner on behalf of the Federal Aviation Administration. This case is an appeal of the statutorily mandated revocation of Mr. Lauterbach's airman certificates. Mr. Lauterbach was criminally convicted of 18 U.S.C. Section 38 for knowingly and with an intent to defraud, making and using materially false records relating to the maintenance of two helicopter rotor blades that he later sold in commerce. On the basis of that conviction, FAA revoked Mr. Lauterbach's airman certificates under the authority of 44726B1A, which requires the FAA to revoke the certificates of an individual who is convicted of a violation of law relating to the sale of fraudulently represented aviation parts and materials.
I'd like to get to the bottom of how the agency interprets 44726B1B. You say in your brief at page 20 that you can establish, you can revoke a certificate based on proving a violation under B1B by a preponderance of the evidence.
That is correct.
So how do you square that with what the FAA said in a rulemaking in 2005? Nobody cited this in their briefs, but it was a rulemaking where they said that under 44726, the statute also permits the FAA to revoke a certificate absent a conviction if the agency determines that the individual has committed acts that would lead to a conviction if pursued criminally. And then it repeats that same language elsewhere. And that's language has been used in an NTSB decision that was cited, the application of Thorough Wayne Law decision.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you square what you say in your brief with that?
Well, subsection B1B requires the FAA to revoke the certificates of an individual when the administrator is able to make a finding that that individual has not only engaged in fraudulent activity, but also that that fraudulent activity is punishable by a law relating to the sale of fraudulently represented aviation parts and materials. So it has to prove by a preponderance that the individual engaged in fraudulent activity and prove by a preponderance that that individual's conduct also is criminally punishable under a law relating to the sale of fraudulently represented aviation parts and materials. And that's what occurred here, is that the attorney handling the case in 2006 determined that there wasn't enough evidence in the record, as she reviewed it, to make the finding that Mr. Lauterbach had engaged in that activity punishable. So she was able to settle that 2006 case. And therefore, the only action that was available to the FAA in 2006, given that attorney's determination, was the general revocation authority under 44709, because Mr. Lauterbach still violated Part 43 of the Federal Aviation Regulations by his conduct. So to address the known safety concern at that time, which was his regulatory violation, the FAA moved forward with an enforcement action under its general revocation authority.
Let me make sure I understand what's at issue and what isn't. Are you disputing the argument that there was a final judgment with respect to the 44726B1B claim in 2006?
Well, there was no final judgment with respect to the B1B claim in 2006 because that case was settled and it was never presented before the NTSB. So the FAA...
Well, you can settle something and there can be a judgment. The judgment can be that we're not pursuing this anymore and that claim is dismissed with prejudice.
Right, so what occurred here was the party settled by mutual compromise. So the only evidence that we have in the record is the amended order of revocation on page 100 of the appendix. And that says that it's being issued pursuant to an agreement between the parties and that Mr. Lauterbach's certificate is only revoked pursuant to 44709.
Well, when I read your brief, and maybe I'm misreading something or missing something, but the only argument I see you making against res judicata is that it's not the same claim.
That is correct.
But you didn't make an argument in your brief that there was no final judgment on the prior claim.
With respect to res judicata, yes. The argument is that these are not the same claim because here there is a new fact, and that new fact is the criminal conviction.
Well, to follow up on Judge Wilkins' question, would you be agreeing with Mr. Zimring, if in fact there had been a final judgment under 44726? In other words,
no.
Does it turn on that?
No. Because had the FAA brought the B1B action in 2006 and lost, it would still not preclude the FAA's action under B1A because they raise different claims. They have different statutory elements and they rely on separate factual predicates.
Yes, but if they brought that B1B action and prevailed. In other words, they were able to show that, in fact, this conduct would have led to a conviction under a fraud provision, would they still argue that the conviction would be a basis for an additional action?
Well, no, because if the FAA had prevailed in 2006 under B1B, Mr. Lauterbach's certificates would be revoked permanently, and so there would be no certificates to revoke at this juncture. And that's kind of the understanding, is that there's...
But how do you square what you told me earlier as far as proving by a preponderance with subsection E of the statute? Because if Congress intended for you to be able to revoke permanently a certificate based on proving by a preponderance that the certificate holder conducted himself in a way that was punishable by law, why would Congress say that if they're acquitted later, then you can't, you know, sustain the revocation under B1B? I mean, you could be acquitted because it wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but you could still be proven to have done it if by preponderance or by clear and convincing evidence. But Congress didn't seem to want that to be the outcome.
That's correct. I think it's a reflection of the different burdens of proof. So it's a reflection that there may be certain circumstances where the FAA may be able to prove an activity where the criminal justice system can't, and vice versa, which is what occurred here. The FAA didn't have the evidence to prove it under B1B. So the FAA is relying on the criminal justice system, which had the additional resources to prove that Mr. Lauterbach engaged in this activity. And B1A states that the FAA can rely exclusively on a criminal conviction to revoke an individual certificate.
Well, what's wrong with looking at if the issue of whether it's the common nucleus of fact turns on kind of determining what the issue and what the fact is? What's wrong with saying that if you look at B1A and B1B, what Congress was doing was defining the fact as whether the person committed an act that was punishable under the criminal law? That's the fact. And so the FAA can choose to go through door number one or door number two. Door number one is we can pursue a criminal conviction. And if we want this person to not be able to operate during that, we can, under 44709, revoke, or we can suspend, because there's a provisions for suspending certificates pending a criminal prosecution. It's right there in the criminal statute. Or you can go through door number two and say, okay, there's not going to be a criminal prosecution, but we have to prove nonetheless that what this person did was punishable under the criminal law. I don't see any way of reading that other than saying that we have to establish that if there were a criminal trial, it would be proven beyond reasonable doubt.
Well, there are two subsections of 44726B1, and they're disjunctive and they're not mutually exclusive. And the reason for that is that there may be certain circumstances where the FAA can't prove the underlying criminal activity, but the criminal justice system can. So the FAA can rely exclusively on that conviction to revoke his certificate.
Then why proceed under B1B? Then you wait for the, you shouldn't have brought it under B1B. Use the other things at your disposal. But if you bring that claim and it gets, you know, settled and dismissed and there's an adjudication, then, you know, you don't get a second bite at the apple.
Well, the FAA initially brought a two-count action in 2006 under B1B and 44709. Before the parties even reached a hearing, the parties settled, and the B1B claim, you know, the attorney determined not to move forward with that action because she determined that there wasn't enough evidence. So the only action available to the FAA at that time to address a known safety issue was the 44709 action. But The facts giving rise to the FAA's revocation in 2006 are not present here. The only operative fact relevant to the FAA's 2013 revocation action is the criminal conviction.
Let me ask you, Ms. Gardner, would the agency have the authority, would it have had the authority in this situation looking at its judgment in the prior civil enforcement action and looking at the result of the criminal proceeding? Does it have discretion under 44726B1A to decline to revoke?
No.
No discretion?
Absolutely. Correct. There is no discretion because the statute itself is mandatory. It says the administrator shall revoke an individual certificate when the administrator finds that that individual has been convicted. There are substantive standards in that statute that constrain the agency's use of discretion.
And you can't just decline to even bring the civil enforcement proceeding?
Well, no, because the reason that the statute is mandatory is that it embodies the judgment that people who engage in this type of criminal or activity pose a serious threat to aviation safety.
And is there, on the front end, after the settlement here under 44709, is there a referral requirement or practice that FAA notifies the U.S. attorney of the potential for criminal investigation?
There isn't necessarily a referral requirement, but it is the agency's practice to refer cases through, I think it's our Office of Inspector General, when there may be some potential criminal activity.
And is there anything in the record about whether that was done here?
There isn't anything in the record, but given that it's the agency's practice, I would presume that is one possible avenue as to how it got to the criminal stage. But at the time that the FAA brought the 2006 action, it had no way of knowing whether there would ever be a future criminal action, much less whether that criminal action would even be meritorious, because here...
And it's unclear whether this is the kind of case that the FAA would have referred, right? Because, in fact, they found that there wasn't enough evidence to proceed under 44726B1B, meaning they didn't even have the civil version of the criminal case in hand.
That is correct. That's the determination that the attorney made at that time in 2006.
I don't understand your argument, though, counsel, because if you're saying that it was mandatory and they had no choice, the administrator has no choice but to revoke when there's a conviction, then it's still mandatory to revoke if the administrator believes that the person committed an act that's punishable by law. I mean, if B1A is mandatory, then B1B is mandatory.
That's correct. Both provisions are mandatory.
And the board said back in the Thurl Wayne Law decision on reconsideration in 2010 that the way that the statute is supposed to work is that it requires a showing that the certificate holder could have been convicted of a crime.
That's correct. But the attorney handling the case in 2006 reviewed the evidence available and determined that there wasn't enough evidence for the administrator to make that finding.
But that's the point with res judicata, is that if you pursue a claim and that requires proof of a fact, here, fact that he committed an act that would be punishable by law, and you don't have the evidence for it, and you drop it, and it's dropped finally, you don't get to re-bring the claim because you find some evidence later that allows you to prove that fact all of a sudden. I mean, if that were the case, we wouldn't have res judicata, because there's would be often the case that maybe you drop something because you don't think that you can prove it, the parties think that the matter's settled, and then you find some new evidence later.
Well, that's correct, but the 2006 action and the 2013 action don't bring the same claim because they're not based on the same facts. If you look at the 2013 order...
But if we define fact as whether he committed an act that was punishable by law, then they are based on the same fact.
Well, the only fact is whether or not he was criminally convicted, and that's a distinct question of whether or not his conduct is punishable by a criminal law.
But doesn't B1B require a showing that he could be convicted if if a prosecution were brought?
It requires a showing that that activity is punishable by a law relating to the sale of fraudulently represented aviation parts or materials.
Why did the board say that it requires a showing that he could have been convicted?
I guess that's a different way of saying the same thing, that if those facts were present in a criminal case, he could be convicted. But the statute itself, the language says, the administrator must show that he's engaged in an activity punishable by a law relating to the sale of fraudulently represented aviation parts or materials. But again, that's not the question that's dispositive in the 2013 action. The only operative question of fact in 2013 is whether or not he was criminally convicted, and here he was by the district court in Texas. And that question was neither raised nor relevant in 2006 because the FAA was required to prove the underlying fraud, not the conviction. And the FAA, you know, is not precluded from bringing an action that it had no opportunity to bring in 2006. Drake stands for the proposition that res judicata doesn't preclude a litigant from bringing an action that it had no opportunity to bring in the past. An FAA could not have brought a B1A action in the past because the criminal conviction, that's the very heart of the 2013 action, postdates the resolution of the 2006 action by almost 5 years. So if you look at these as pragmatically, they don't form the same series of events, and they don't form a convenient trial unit. So they're not the same claim under the standard of res judicata.
That's if you view the conviction as, I guess, establishing some sort of a claim outside of what B1B, the core of B1B, which is whether he committed an act that's punishable under the criminal statute. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems like you're slicing the bologna awful thin here.
I guess, you know, I have something of the same question, and I'm just trying to understand what the government's position is here, because I thought you said that if you had prevailed under B1B, that is, if you could have shown this by a preponderance, then you wouldn't have acted under B1A, or did I misunderstand you?
Yes, that's correct, because the revocation under B1B is permanent, so it permanently revokes all of his certificates. Okay. And the point of a revocation action is to make sure that an individual certificate holder can't continue to jeopardize aviation safety. So had the FAA prevailed in 2006 and permanently revoked his certificates, we wouldn't need to be here because he wouldn't have any certificates.
So both of these would result in a permanent revocation?
That's correct. Both B1B and B1A are permanent revocations, and that's an understanding of the importance of making sure that people who engage in this type of conduct and who are willing to put unsafe parts into the stream of commerce no longer have a continued ability to jeopardize aviation safety.
So just to tie that up, for example, if you had proceeded under 44726B1B and then for whatever reason, you know, squishy evidence, wanting to get the case closed so you could put resources elsewhere, had settled that case for a 20-year revocation, as a matter of settlement, could you even do that? You couldn't. That's why you go over to 709.
That's correct.
Okay. So there's no such thing as a B1B that isn't a lifetime revocation.
That's correct.
And therefore, once B1B has been invoked, your obligations under B1A don't exist, even though there may be good reason to prosecute criminally.
That's correct. Subsection A of 44726 says that the administrator will never grant an additional certificate. So not only is the certificate revoked, but if they reapply, the administrator is without authority to issue a new certificate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I've gone over my time. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Zimmerman, you had no time remaining, but we'll give you 2 minutes if you need it.
I shouldn't need even that much, and I appreciate that, Your Honor, very much. I don't think it follows that the FAA, even under the law, the MTSB's decision, Wayne Law, would have to prove a B1B matter beyond a reasonable doubt. It's still a preponderance of the evidence. It's before the, it would be a proceeding brought before an MTSB ALJ and ultimately the MTSB. So even though the language says it, an activity punishable under law, I don't think it follows that it would have to be proven by the FAA beyond a reasonable doubt. It would still be the preponderance of the evidence standard.
So what does it mean when they say that he could have been convicted?
Well, I think that in their belief there are facts that would sustain the elements of one of the criminal convictions that would trigger this, like the one he was ultimately convicted of. I don't, just because there is enough evidence that could sustain it doesn't mean it has to be proven in every proceeding beyond a reasonable doubt. Much like an indictment, there just has to be enough evidence to show that it could pass the jury, doesn't necessarily have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. Ms. Gardner stated that the initial FAA attorney handling the case made the decision that there wasn't enough evidence to proceed under this B-1B. The record's very clear, and indeed the FAA has admitted in the record, there's no new evidence. There's nothing, there's not a single piece of new evidence that was that was uncovered or placed before any tribunal after the 2006 final order.
Did Mr. Lauterbach appeal the criminal conviction for insufficiency of the evidence?
No, not that I'm aware of. My father is the other lawyer on this brief. Neither of us were involved with the criminal proceeding, but to best of my knowledge, he did not. And then finally, the FAA's position is basically boiled down to, we couldn't punish him for the actions that we believe he did in 2004, 2005, so we didn't punish him. However, somebody else punished him, that being the Department of Justice and District Court. Now it's their position that they get to punish him simply because he was punished by somebody
else. Not that they get to, but that they actually have no discretion.
So, that's their position. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.